Welcome to Tribe Podcast, Episode 3, where our mission is to normalize mental health by creating an open narrative for our people's protectors, one conversation at a time. 22 veterans commit suicide every day. We hope to help turn the tide by giving an inside look at the psychological rigors of being one of our nation's protectors and act as a platform for medical professionals to speak about their approaches to curb the effects of PTSD, TBI, and depression. Today, we're joined by Tribe co-founder Gunner Joey Patrico as we continue our conversation from episode 2 and dive into his mental health struggles and experience at the Mission Resiliency Laurel Ridge Treatment Center. Gunner, thanks for coming on.
Hey, what's going on? I just want to say, you know, I love how you try to make this so professional. You're very professional. I love it.
That's why you brought me on board.
I know. And I'm, just a gunner. That's where it comes from. But no, happy to be here.
So, Gunner, last episode we started to dive into, number one, your suicide attempt right after Christmas this past year. Moved into the Laurel Ridge Treatment Center, which is in Texas.
Right.
We talked about your initial counseling session, kind of your setup with your therapist, your psychiatrist, and what your day-to-day was like.
Yeah.
I recall you saying it was a very military schedule where you had a very definitive blocks of time to go eat in the morning, go to your counseling sessions, go socialize with the other veterans and, you know, fellow survivors of post-traumatic stress. And it was an extensive experience. Today, I want to dive further into that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. When we talk about the schedule is posted. Like there's weeks 1 through 4. And then if you're there long enough, because it's only supposed to be 28 days. If you're there long enough, you go back to like week 1. So it's like a repeat of everything you learned in weeks 1 through 4. It's pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah. Monday through Sunday. It's good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's kick off with, I just want to rehash, you show up to Laurel Ridge,
yep.
The tribe, the other patients who are at the hospital take you in, right? It's
yep.
very much a tight-knit community. There's a very good understanding from those guys as to what you've been through. And all these guys are seasoned warriors,
yeah.
right? They're all very, I mean, the average time in service was how many years?
It was 16 years.
16 years, a lot of special operations guys,
a lot of
infantry guys.
Yep.
So all guys who've gone out and done very similar mission sets to what you've done in the past.
Right. Yeah. So there's a wide range from, you know, on the officer side, we're looking at the lowest rank was honestly me being a chief warrant officer too. But looking at lieutenant colonel to colonel, and then enlisted side, you're looking at like staff sergeant, senior staff sergeant, E6, all the way up to E9.
Wow.
With like 20 plus years, the senior.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's a seasoned group, to say the least.
Yes. And yeah, you can imagine the personalities there.
Sure.
It was great. Social experiment at its finest.
So, as you met with your therapist,
yep.
Actually, before we even get to that,
okay.
Showing up to Laurel Ridge, were you on any sort of drugs? Had you been written a prescription yet to help with your mental health?
No. I've never taken mental health drug. We'll say like antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication. No.
Okay, and so, after showing up to Laurel Ridge, how long did it take for your psychiatrist to actually write you a script?
24 hours.
Okay.
Day one.
So what do they put you on?
People don't know, but there's a litany of antidepressant drugs and like anti-anxiety drugs. For me personally, I'm only on one drug, and it's Lexapro. And I started at, there's two doses. You could start at 10. Which is the lowest, 10 milligrams. And then it takes like 3 weeks to get in your system and to start to have an impact. But I ended up being at 20 by the end. So I started at 10 milligrams for 3 weeks. And then the effect wasn't good enough. And I jumped to 20 where I'm at now.
So off the bat, you show up. They just do they blanket everyone onto a Lexapro prescription?
No.
What is that initial interaction with your psychiatrist like, where they pinpoint Lexapro as the drug to put you on?
So I think I was in a different case, right? So for me, so I think the inpatient part for other individuals is like a second step. Like a second step of their treatment. Like they went to, you know, intense outpatient before, it wasn't working for them. So then they jumped into inpatient.
Okay.
Like, and a lot of them were, you know, which isn't wrong, like there because they were told to go there, like they need to go. Vice versa, me, who made a phone call and said I needed help. So I wasn't forced to go. I made that call on my own.
And so for the vast majority of the other patients, they were ordered to go.
I think some of them, yeah, most of them.
Okay, and is that even, I mean, is that legal? Can your command do that?
I think, I think the medical side can.
The medical side can. Yeah. Do you know what that conversation sounds like for those people?
No, I mean, I think some of them want help, right? Some of them need the help and they're like, this isn't working, I need, you know, and it's just the progression of the program for them. So they'll go to like intense outpatient. So say we're on Camplogen. Like if someone has these problems, they'll go to intense outpatient until like it's not working. And then you go to inpatient. Kind of like, and I hate to use this analogy, it's like a drug addict, right? You go to like AA,
right,
or whatever, whatever the other one is. But it's not working. Then you have to go to like an inpatient rehab.
Okay.
So for some of those guys and girls, like they had two steps and they continue steps after. For me,
you went directly in.
Yeah, full bore.
Okay. So you show up.
Yep.
Meet with your psychiatrist, put you on Lexapro. You said it takes about 3 weeks to get into your system.
Right.
What are the effects mentally, especially someone who's never taken an antidepressant, any sort of, you know, mental stimulating drug or anything to affect your mind space?
So the first like 48 hours, I was exhausted. Like it put me asleep.
Okay.
Like I was out of it. And I was like, something's not right. Something's wrong. And I told the doctor, I'm like, something's wrong. Like, I'm exhausted. And this was like day three. And I'm like, I'll give it 24 more hours just to see. Cause I didn't know. Right. And then day five, the sleeping, I like planed out, like plain, I wasn't sleepy anymore.
You were not sleeping at all.
No, I was sleeping. I wasn't tired.
Okay.
Like it was making me sleep all day. I was having normal days.
Okay.
And for the effect, I didn't feel it until like 2 weeks. Like it was slow burn to get into your system. And once it got in my system, like I could slow my thoughts down. Like my mind wasn't racing 500 miles per hour every minute and I'm thinking of 10 million things.
I mean, as for anyone who doesn't know you, you are a, you know, 100 miles a minute type of guy.
Yeah.
You also have ADHD.
Yep.
And you are a very naturally energetic guy.
Yeah.
So slowing everything down, how did that affect your ability to bring it back in, do a little internal analysis, and really figure out where you were at that point?
Fuck. So to be completely honest, something I struggle with today,
mm-hmm.
I will tell you that I must have read so many books trying to figure out what was wrong with me. I was trying to self-diagnose as a doctor and figure out what was going on, right? Because they only give you like, you know, the, you know, 33,000 foot look at what's wrong with you. They're not giving you the deep dive. And I'm like, oh, well, I want the deep dive. I want to know every little thing.
So within those first couple days, you're super tired, you're on this drug, you're sleeping all day. What's your day-to-day like that's enabling you to sleep all day?
No, I just slept. And they just let you.
You didn't have to show up to the meetings.
No, they let you.
You didn't have appointments. So would you say that's a normal...
Yeah.
So this is a common thing that most people go through.
Yeah.
You go to inpatient and it is, they put just about everyone on an antidepressant.
Yeah, they throw drugs at you.
They throw drugs at you. Antidepressants across the board. Anything else get thrown at you?
People are on so much different stuff. I can't even.
Okay.
I don't even know. You're talking about meds after med after med.
Got it. But in your case, it's just the antidepressant.
Yep.
You get super tired, and that is something that is seen across the board.
Yeah,
It takes you a couple days to get out.
Yep.
And during that time, you are trying to self-diagnose.
Yep, and as I, was going into my mental breakdown on the day of that I tried to kill myself, leading up to that point, I was also trying to self-diagnose.
Okay.
So, I knew something wasn't going right, and I wanted to fix it immediately.
And how far did you get into that diagnosis?
I was down I was this rabbit hole.
Did you ever come to a conclusion?
Yeah, it was trauma, moral injury. But then I was really confused because TBI has the same symptoms as PTSD. So I was caught in a conundrum of is TBI the issue? Or do I have trauma? And this is before I knew what moral injuries was, which I'm sure we're going to get into.
Yeah, and I do want to dive into that.
Okay.
So the first 4 days, again, you're super tired. You kind of come out of that. You're trying to self-diagnose.
Yep.
At this point, your therapy appointments pick up?
Yep. Yeah, so obviously we talked about the first therapy with my therapist, and just big picture, what's going on.
Big picture.
Yep.
Your therapist is getting to know you.
Yes.
And you are told to do what?
Write my deployment timelines of all the significant events that happened on all my deployments.
And that was anytime anyone died.
Yep.
Anytime you guys got in a gunfight. I'm sure it involved probably the vehicle explosion that you were in that got you your Purple Heart.
Yep.
It was
a whole notebook full of significant events.
And that took you a week to write.
Yeah.
So you write that out, and now I think we're all cut up here. You go into therapy session number two.
And I bring my notebook in, sit in the chair, and my therapist my therapist is a monster. She's a beast. And she will pull everything out of you.
Mm-hmm.
She's super aggressive, and I love her to death. And she asked me, she's like, what is your triggering event? What gives you the most problem? And I'm looking at this notebook, and I'm let's just go back to the first one. The first one I wrote down. Because obviously it was, it was the first. So she's like, okay, we'll go over this.
And what was that about?
So in Iraq on my first deployment.
You were, at this point, 19 years old?
I was 19 years old, Lance Corporal, didn't know.
Before your special operations career, yep. Even took off.
Yeah.
You're a conventional infantry Marine.
Yeah. Four months into the Marine Fleet Force.
And you had graduated from high school a year. Maybe 18 months ago.
Maybe, yeah, if that.
Okay.
Yep. So just got out of SOI. Got out of SOI in September, deployed in January.
Got it.
Late January to Iraq. And this was 4 or 5 weeks into deployment. It was the fifth week. And we were doing hunter-killer missions.
What are those?
So hunter-killer mission is a small element, a fire team. So a fire team from the squad goes out and to a key location and basically sets up a hide site, an observation site, to identify and prosecute any military targets that are like in placing IEDs or doing,
nefarious activities. Okay. Yep. So your platoon commander comes to you, comes to your squad leader, right?
What squad leader was big.
You were the squad leader.
Yeah.
So comes to you, tasks you with this mission.
Right.
You guys go out. Let's talk through what happens.
Yeah. So we could lead up to the tasking of a hunter killer mission. When I asked, what is a hunter killer mission?
You had no idea.
No clue. Right. That it's not even a doctrinal task.
Okay.
Right. It's, so I'm like, what is this? And the only thing I had to fall back on at the time was my 3 TAC-11, which is the rifleman or the Marine Infantry Squad handbook. So that's the only thing I had, right? And like this skill set of understanding tactics and placing people.
Okay.
At such a young age. So really I was like, what am I doing? And he's like, you're going to go to this location, and gave me the grid and pointed to it on the map. And you're going to set up basically a defensive position. Look at this road, this intersection where they've been placing IEDs. And anybody who you see is placing an IED or looks like they're going to hurt or might kill coalition forces, you are going to take care of it. And I said, Roger. So then... I went to I knew where it was because I read the book 100 times, the page where it was for planning, and I went through the checklist of doing a 5-paragraph order, task organization, all patrol overlay, all the things.
You come up with your plan.
Oh yeah. Came up with my plan, took four guys included, plus myself, which was 5. We departed at this location, which was the Northern Iraqi Army Army base in Karma, right? We departed at 2 a.m., walked 2 hours through the fields, jumping over like these creeks, these like little creeks of shit, like full of human feces. That were just running through the farm fields, trying not to get identified, like burn ourselves, like get compromised as we're moving in. And of course, as we're moving, I'm 5'5", and one of these shit creeks were too far for me to jump. So I was basically chest deep in human feces.
Why was there human feces throughout these?
Because they don't have sewers.
Got it.
Yeah, so... all the piss, shit, and water is like running all over the place. Yeah.
Got it.
But anyway, so it's like 3:30 in the morning. I'm covered in human poop. I stunk really bad. As we're moving, and I'm in controlling this to a location, so we can get eyes on this road. So we moved up, still dark, under the cover of darkness. Of note, the year was 2006, so not everyone had NVGs.
Night vision.
So not everyone had night vision. There were 5 of us. 2 of us had night vision. So you could imagine how that was going.
So moving out there is tough. It is a emotional experience in itself.
It was an emotional experience in itself. But we didn't get compromised. And then we moved up to like this abandoned structure that was perfect position to observe the road. It was like 200-300 meters away from the road. It was the only piece of cover in this whole area, and it's the only thing that would protect us if we got in a firefight, and we could defend it, and we couldn't be really seen at that time. So I'm like, all right, cool, we're gonna stop here, we're gonna place security, and then start a watch plan in order to get eyes on this road all day till the sun goes back down.
Okay, so you guys are manning security.
Yep. So we're doing, two guys on, one guy on the radio and 2 guys down.
Okay.
In order, to have a rest plan. And me and Pat Nolan were towards the end of the day, on our watch, on my watch schedule. Nothing happened all day. It was super boring, super hot. And it was, I smelled like shit, right? So the machine gun was in between me and Pat, which was the 249 at the time. And then we had, he had the M16 with the 203. And then I was just going to, you know, use the saw, the squad automatic weapon. And I gave my rifle to the guy who had the saw, who normally carried the saw, so he had a weapon. We're just sitting there, me and him were just bullshitting, and it was super boring. And I remember, you know, my own personal comfort-based decision is I wanted to leave during the day. So I didn't want to walk through the shit creeks again, and I wanted to see. So I made that call. I'm like, hey, we're going to leave in like 2 hours. So we're going to pack up before the sun goes down, but whatever. It's kind of irrelevant, right? I just knew that I was going to be on the last post. An hour and a half in, we saw a vehicle that was coming down the road at a super high speed. And it was running perpendicular on the road where they in place IEDs. The key, I can't draw a map, right? But the key factor off that main road running basically right to the right of our position as we're looking at the perpendicular road was a donkey trail, which assessed at the time a vehicle could not drive down. But my assessment was completely wrong. And a vehicle made a left onto this donkey trail, flying. And the rules of engagement at the time were you had to ground, basically shoot the ground, warning shot, then shoot the grill of the car to take out the engine block. And if that doesn't work, you shoot the windshield and the occupants, right? Because of VBID threats and all that. But we were so tight on between the time and space between our location and the road, I mean, was minimal. So there was that car made a left off the main road, and we were like, it's a donkey trail. They're coming at us. We need to, you know, there's no time for, you know, warn, grill, and then put around, you know. So I grabbed the automatic weapon and let the car hopefully stop. But it didn't stop. And then.
So you engaged the car.
Oh, I engaged the car.
Both shooting at the engine block and at the driver?
Yeah. So I shot from basically the top of the hood, the front of the car, and just let the automatic weapon go.
Okay. So you shot probably 100
rounds? 150
rounds. 150 rounds. Yep. M249, belt-fed weapon,
yep.
Automatic fires. And what happens to the car?
So the car slowly comes to a stop. Now everything for me at that time, like I could hear my heart rate in my head. Obviously my adrenaline was pumping. I was sweating and I was just like, I thought I missed the car. Like I literally thought I missed, one because I didn't have like, you know, a sight on the weapon. It was iron sight. So just looking, you know. I was literally watching the tracers, and I thought I missed. But the slow car came to a stop, and I'm like, all right, we're going to get up. We're going to push up to this car, and we're going to, like, search it and go from there. And then so we broke down, and we moved up to the car, held security around the car, and then moved up to the car and then looked, like, did not miss the car. There was like 15 rounds in the engine block, and I don't know how many went through the windshield, a lot. That event, there was three occupants in the vehicle, one in the front seat and two in the back seat. And because they didn't stop, right, and protecting the squad, we had to, or the fire team, had to stop the car. So I killed everyone in the vehicle at the time. And not going to get too in-depth in the who's in the vehicle, but
so you go up, you observe the three now bodies in the car.
Yeah, me and Pat Nolan.
Your buddy,
mm-hmm.
your buddy pair.
Yep.
You observe this. What's your initial reaction?
My initial reaction is I saw the driver, I saw the occupant in the back left seat, but my eyes cue to the back right seat. I mean, it smelled like burnt plastic, gunpowder, iron, and all I could see was the person in the back right seat. And then for me, I like emotionally, I guess, lost my cool as a leader. Because I fell to my knees, I threw up on myself, and I was cursing, just because, right, these people were just driving their car probably home, and, you know, nobody knew, right? We didn't know if there was a VBIT, right? Because we were getting in firefights all the time.
And it, of course, yeah. It's like one of the, you know, you engage within the rules of engagement, right. And it is one of the risks that policy set in that theater, yep. Has accepted.
Right.
Obviously, it went for the worse, and that the risk that accepted ended up turning out for the worse in that given scenario, which ended up killing the occupants of that car.
Right.
So you lose control.
I lose control, throw up. I was crying. It just wasn't, something felt off, or it was off, right? I was off at that moment. And the only way, like, I came to my cool is because Pat Nolan, right? This is a key factor of the story, is Pat shook me and brought me out because we saw what was in the car.
Right.
Everyone else was kind of pushed away, and we both kept it that way. And he's like, hey, we gotta go. Pat Nolan also was 19 years old. We were baby Marines together, both Lance Corporals.
Mm-hmm.
And he shook me out of it, and then we just went. You know, I flipped the switch of like emotions are gone at this moment because I had to like get back, report, do all the things. So like I snapped out of it and shut down emotions, to the point I threw my Kevlar like on the ground, and I never throw my Kevlar.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing for me, but I turned very angry like in that moment after he shook me out of it.
So did that moment affect the remainder of your deployment emotionally?
In that moment, yes. Yeah, it affected my life, right? And I'll tell you why. Because I basically turned black. Like, my heart turned black in that moment. Like, I don't think I cried until recently. Didn't feel emotions. Couldn't go near... I couldn't be near, like, families, we'll say. Right, with like, you know, a family of kids and, you know, mom, dad, all that stuff. I couldn't be near that. I got super uneasy in those environments.
Mm-hmm.
To include with my kids, right? Like, I kept time and space away from children and stuff like that.
So as you tell your therapist in Texas at the the inpatient center that you were at, this story.
Mm-hmm.
What are the following questions that you're asked?
Well, a lot of it was like driving the emotion and the sense out of me, right? Like, what were you smelling? What were you feeling? What was your body doing? What was your reaction? And that's how I could tell you, like, my smells just now.
Right.
Is because those are the questions she was asking, because those are triggering those events, to include like the avoidance of, you know, certain individuals.
And was that very prevalent information in your mind, or was that something that it took you a while of reflecting to kind of come back to?
She had to drive it out of me, because that my story was not, I mean, and it was a lot more in depth than what I just told, right? A lot more in depth. But she had to drop, like, I was, you know, glossing over, like, to the point she drove, like, what was the color of the car? You know, like, I had to draw, I drew the map of the location.
So as you're diving deeper into this scenario with your therapist, again, it's therapy session number two.
Yep.
And you are just going into the details.
Yep.
Are you feeling resistant in that moment to provide these details? Have you fully, at this point in your inpatient therapy, have you gone fully transparent yet?
No, I was still pushing back, like super hard on therapy.
And what was driving that pushback?
I didn't think, at the, like my first 2-3 weeks there, it wasn't clicking. I didn't think I needed to be there. Right. I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, oh, the other guys are way worse than me. Like, I don't have any of this, like these events like that. Like, cause I wasn't putting my events together, in a full picture. Right. It was still like blocked out. I'm like, oh no, I'm good. So like, and she knew, like she could tell, right? But as she like is asking me questions, like I'm thinking, cause I want to get better, right? So I'm like thinking and then, telling the story and reminding like the sense and, you know, what was going on. It like broke me down. I was like super upset. Now remember, this is therapy session number two. Like, I didn't hit my moment yet.
So moving on from therapy session number two, or really in therapy session number two, is that the only event that you guys covered?
That is the only event that we covered.
Okay. And so let's push into follow-on therapy sessions. Let's go to 3 and 4. At this point, how long have you been at the hospital?
So 3 and 4, 1, 2, 3. That's probably week 2.5, 3. Going on week 3. And it was really just like replaying this. Because she taped the second one. And I had to listen to that tape every day. And
Would you listen to it alone?
I would listen to it alone with headphones on.
And that was ordered by your therapist?
Yeah.
Okay. As you're listening to this, what's going on?
All emotions are coming to me. And I'm writing it like in a notebook, like how I'm feeling, what's going on. Right? Because the goal is, the end state was, it's not your fault. And I blamed myself. And I say Pat Nolan was a key factor, because in 2012, Pat Nolan killed himself. Mm-hmm. And I blamed myself for that till 2023.
Right.
Right? Because me and him were the only two people that looked in that car.
Right.
So
as you listen, you're listening to this every day, you're journaling your emotions. Yep. As you keep on extrapolating information from this session, are you bringing new things to the conversation in therapy sessions number 3 and 4, or are you feeling that it's just a regurgitation of your emotions, which you experienced in therapy session number 2?
So what it did was, one, it made me not blame myself, right? Like the Pat Nolan thing, I didn't realize till after listening to that thing like 15 times, of like the second and third order effects after that, and what that one event, how it shaped, we'll say, the rest of my life. That one event, I'm like, what can I take from that one event and listening to it and going over the lessons of how I'm feeling from 19 years old to 36 years old, and all the things I did in between then were based off of that event.
And as you were living your day-to-day life, coming back from that deployment, again, you mentioned difficulties being in familial atmospheres, difficulties being around people and engaging with people and having emotions.
Yeah.
Were you thinking back to that moment, or could you not identify the trigger of those actions?
What do you mean?
So, as you were uncomfortable with your family and with yep. your kids, were you thinking back to that specific moment where you shot the individuals in the car?
Then I started to, yeah. I'm like, why? Yeah. I didn't put two and two together. It didn't click until I started going over this. So then I started putting it into perspective.
Once in therapy. Okay, got it.
Yeah, I took all... right, so that event shaped who I was as a Marine in a lot of ways, to the point of not knowing what a hunter killer mission was, right? Because I said I would never ever have somebody go out and not know what is going on. Mm-hmm. So I committed myself to ensuring that never happened to the young 19-year-old Lance Corporal that might find himself in charge of a squad that could have strategic effects at the lowest level, at the tactical level. That 19-year-old Lance Corporal, or E3, could change the landscape of a whole battle space in a negative way. And that could have been me that day. I thought I was going to jail when I was on my knees.
Right.
I thought I was going to jail, because I didn't know. Like, I didn't know what the fuck was going on.
Right.
Yeah.
And you didn't know how the rules of engagement at the time protected you. You didn't understand the second, third order effects of the actions that you'd taken. And then ultimately, and very obviously, you didn't understand the effects that that moment would take on your personal life.
Right.
Additionally, it shaped your ability to, as we've talked about many times throughout the podcast, this on-off switch,
yep.
right? Which I think most Marines have.
Yeah, they have.
And it's your ability to get extremely uncomfortable, not process pain, whether it's emotionally or physically,
yep.
And just execute at all costs.
Yep.
However, as you've mentioned, the more you do that, it becomes a very comfortable space.
Very comfortable. It's you, yeah.
And it becomes your identity.
Yep. It becomes who you are.
And it allows everything external to your life that is not the Marine Corps and operational efficiency to go by the wayside.
Yes. Yes. And I think that, and right, like, what's the mission of the military, right? It has to defend the Constitution of the United States against enemies, foreign and domestic, right? There's a purpose behind it. And I get that, right? You get that, right? The military is built to fight wars and fight for the country, to ensure that people don't come here and, you know, take a fight to us on our homeland. So I get it. I get it. I'll tell you that I didn't get it then at 19 years old. I didn't get that. I didn't know. When I came home, I didn't know what combat stress was. I didn't know what PTSD was.
Right.
I didn't know what any of that was.
And at what point, or if at any point in your career, did you gain an understanding for that?
I think in the 2015-ish, 2014-ish, the push started to come on under, like, PTSD is a thing.
Right.
Did I understand it? No. I knew the symptoms, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Right? From the mandatory, you know, wave top of briefs we got.
Right. And at this point, you know, you're already in special operations.
Yeah.
You've gone on now multiple combat deployments.
Yeah, I'm just going.
You've gone on multiple missions.
Yep.
Where you guys have gotten to kinetic warfare. Mm-hmm. You know, trading gunshots with enemies.
Yeah.
And at this point, you're also starting to dive into your personal stresses from, like, a personal study standpoint.
Yeah. Right?
You've identified that something's wrong.
Yep.
And you are diving into this.
Yep.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned earlier today was that TBI and PTSD have the same symptoms.
Right.
What are those symptoms?
So there's actually three. So one's not categorized as a, what is the word I'm looking for? Categorized as a, like, so you have TBI, you have PTSD.
Right.
There's a third one, which is moral injury.
Okay.
Right, which is not in the books yet. It's not like signed off that this is a diagnosis.
Right.
So it's covered under PTSD. But again, if you draw three circles, there's an overlap between all these diagnoses.
So within the Venn diagram, the center point is...
Yeah, so anger, isolation, risky behavior, you know, there's, you know, just like, I mean, for PTSD more so, like avoidance, dialectical thinking, like worst case scenario stuff. Yeah, there's a lot.
How would you define moral injury?
So moral injury, right? This is where things get hairy, right? So PTSD would be like, I experienced a traumatic event, and I'm avoiding everything that has to do with that event.
Okay.
Right? From, you know, standing watchful at night, right? Because I'm, you know, nervous, right? Moral injury is, you know, take all those symptoms, but add in like, morally, I wasn't raised to just kill people, right? I'm not, like, morally, that's wrong. You know, like, morally, we could go back to Vietnam when guys are, you know, burning villages, right? That's not who they are.
So it's the antithesis of the way that you carry out your life, right?
Yeah, stop bringing up
your integrity.
Yeah,
it goes against what you believe in, goes against how you believe you should live life, and how common culture has raised people to align in terms of virtues.
Right, and that, I mean, as a society, as an American society, that's who we are, right? Like, how many people are raised to like go conduct murder, right? None of us. You know?
So as you get to Laurel and you are, you know, talking about this stuff with your therapist, and she brings up this moral injury
thing,
what is, how is she addressing it? How is she talking about it? And how is she decoupling that from PTSD?
Right, because the event in itself and my follow-on events were not based off, based off something that you would normally experience in warfare, right? So not because my buddy got, you know, his legs blown off. For me, I expected that, right? Like, I knew I was going to kill a dude who was shooting at me.
Right.
And I will be completely transparent. I do not care or blink an eye at one person that I killed that was shooting at me.
Right.
I don't care.
Because we are raised as a society that is okay. That right. The other guy wearing the other uniform who's shooting at you, it is okay for you to shoot him.
Yes.
And kill him.
Right.
However, it is not okay to engage someone who is not directly involved in warfare, which is something that, you know, we saw run rampant throughout Operation Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, in the emplacement of improvised explosive devices in scenarios just like you explained, right? It is a thing where you now, I mean, the enemies that we were fighting, the extremist groups that we were fighting out there, hid in plain sight in civilian clothes, and they use that to their advantage, which, as a society, we believe is dirty warfare.
Right.
And they use that to their advantage, and what that caused was a numerous amount of moral injuries on U.S. soldiers and Marines, like you experienced.
Yep.
And so all of the critical events, all of the significant events that you talked about and that you outlined in your journal that you discussed with your therapist were directly related to moral injuries and vice post-traumatic stress.
Yep.
They were all things that went against the norms of humanity in our eyes.
Right. 100%.
So, as your therapy sessions progressed, you've gone in depth now a number of times into this scenario that you described. You're listening to it on a daily basis.
Yep.
You're going through the emotions associated with it in such a granular level where you're really reliving this on a daily basis.
Daily.
At what point did you guys slap the table on that event, if ever, and were like, okay, we now know everything about this event and now we're going to move on? Or was this just a theme throughout your entire experience?
So it was the theme, but it also drove everything else, as in my life. So why am I the way I'm like doing this in my life? Like, what's going on in my brain that's making me do this? Or why is my personality this way? Why am I like this? Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So this event was the trigger for...
Yeah, it's second editions.
The falling out of multiple facets of your life.
Yeah. Yeah, it set conditions to go into everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the one thing Laurel Ridge does really, really well is the group sessions, right? Because you could go over everything in therapy, but I'm just talking to a therapist.
Right.
It's
all private.
Yeah. It's a different ballgame when you take all these guys and girls who were in combat situations and put them in a like room that's designed to tell your story.
So what's that like? Set the stage.
Yeah. So it's a room. It's called the War Room. And you go in there every day except for Wednesday and Saturday and Sunday. And the War Room is where you, when you're ready, you share your triggered, your event. Like you share your tragedy or your trauma with everybody else. Like everybody else in the unit.
Is it something that you prepare a speech to? Do you speak openly about it?
Yeah, so everyone's different, right? So for me, I wrote out the story. I wrote out what led up to going out on that mission, like the first 3 weeks of the deployment, and how I ended up being the guy, and then going into like the whole story of, you know, the mission planning, not knowing what was going on, like all the emotions. Other people just do timelines. It's all up to the individual who's talking about it, right? Because that's like the first time most of us have spoke. Like for me, like it was my first time I ever spoke about it, right? No one knew other than the people who were there.
Your wife didn't know.
Nobody knew.
No one from work knew.
Nope. Didn't talk about it. Ever. That was the first time in my therapy session I talked about it. And then going over, and I told, everyone in the War Room. I read my story.
What did that feel like?
So this story, I wrote it. It was like 40 pages in a notebook. It took me 15 minutes to tell the story the first time. I did it twice. The second time was I wanted to do it again. But the first time I read the story, it was like 15 minutes. It was like a machine gun coming out of my mouth. But honestly, after, even though it was a machine gun, I was super fast and probably, I don't know how many breaths I took, but it was like a monkey off my shoulder. Like, I felt like this weird relief. Like something was, I let something go.
So you felt an emotional reprieve,
yeah.
Right? You felt a massive release of something that had been pent up in you for...
Yeah. Ever. Eight to, since 16 19 years. Yeah.
And now it's out there.
It's out there.
Well, emotionally, while you're giving this story, are you crying? You mentioned the first time you were speaking a mile a minute.
I was stuttering. I didn't cry.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't cry. I got choked up a couple times, but I didn't cry. I think the story itself did not trigger the emotion. What triggered the emotion was the aftermath, right? Like, the why. Like, why did I, what was going on? Like, I blamed myself. So really the emotion was like, I blame myself for the position. I blame myself for the location I put the fire team. I blame myself for Pat. I blame myself for not, you know, waiting a second, one more second, to see what would have happened. I played this situation over my head so many times. So that was the hard part, right? Of like Monday morning, quarterbacking myself on like, what did I do wrong? And this should have never happened. So that was really...
So you had survivor's guilt.
Yeah, it was horrible, right? I took three innocent... I mean, I took lives, right? Which is, you know, if anybody says taking a life is good, like they're clinically insane, because it's not natural by any means. And it was just, I was like, I carried that with me, like that vehicle, specifically the back right of that vehicle, I took with me for 18 years.
And so the first time you give it, mm-hmm. you feel this
relief,
immense relief. Mm-hmm. Going back to your room at the end of the night there that night, how are you feeling?
I was good. Like I was actually like smiling. It was like a relief. It was crazy. I can't explain it. Like it's, I hate to use the word magical, but it's magical.
And is that something common that you saw throughout everybody?
Yep.
So is that why the institution makes people do that?
They don't make everyone do it. Some people aren't ready.
Mm-hmm.
I think who drives it is the other patients because of what happens. Like that magical moment when everything is like let out there and it's like you're leaving it in that spot. You're leaving it in that room. And then you have this support network of all these people who get it, right? They're there. Like they get it. They're not judging you. They're not, you know, you could stutter every word and they're not going to judge you. To the point, like after you tell anybody who tells their story, everyone gets a hug. Like it's like, you know, get a hug.
Mm-hmm.
Hugs are free.
So
it's a big deal.
Absolutely. So as you put that out there, now how does your therapy change?
So I think for me, I think everyone's different, but for me personally, like mine was driven around like, you know, my life following that, right? Like still, because I still run 100 miles per hour.
Right.
And I still have hard time living in the moment without Monday morning quarterbacking everything. Like, where can I do to fix this? What can I do to fix this? What can I do to fix this? So really changing that mindset, that self-blame. I have a lot of self-blame for a lot of things. I blame myself for a lot.
And how are you working on not blaming yourself for a lot of things?
That's really hard. That's the hardest thing. Because it's life, right? Like, so I, for me personally, I write a lot, I read a lot, but I write. I've never written before, and I write notebooks now. Like I write every day, and really putting my emotions and like what I'm thinking down on paper helps me clear my mind, if that makes sense.
And is that a practice that's recommended by therapists?
So I think there's multiple, right? There's grounding. Grounding, which is like I'm utilizing breathing techniques to slow my thoughts and basically, you know, slow my thoughts down enough to see that this is not the end of the world. really it's, you know, slowing, for me, slowing down my heart rate, right? Because my heart rate goes through the roof. And I get, it's anxiety, right? Like an anxiety attack in theory, but I don't pass out or whatever happens in anxiety attack. Like I just, it's my trigger to go 0 to 100. So everything, like all my adrenaline goes through the roof. Everything goes through the roof. And I'm very like a bulldog running through a wall.
So when you're in the state where you are seemingly going 100 miles an hour,
yep.
How do you identify it and then pull back?
My heart rate. It starts with my heart rate for me.
What does your heart rate get up to?
Oh, I don't even know. So my heart rate was up to 164 today. The highest.
Well, sedentary?
Yeah, not doing anything. Yeah.
And your mind just started going?
Yeah, goes 100 miles per hour. Like, I can't even tell you what I'm thinking because it just goes. And it's like the fight or flight response, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm doing something. I can't tell you what I'm doing, but I'm like, it's automatic.
And what brings that on? In your day-to-day life?
I think now just life stressors, right? Because life stressors is putting me into fight mode. Like when I feel like I have to fight. Not like physically, obviously, because I don't have a gun. I'm not going to war. But it's like I'm fighting for myself, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Right? So like, you know, me and you are having like a tiff, an argument. And you say something that completely is against who I am or what I think or... Like, it's like, I'm taking it as a personal attack when it's really not, right? So it could just be one word, and I'm 0 to 100. And I'm driving whatever my fight is to you.
Okay, and how is that manifested?
Like, what do I think about?
Yeah, and what do you do?
Oh, I do all kinds of, like, I'm really bad with my words. Like, I will jab you with a knife of words. That I don't even know what they mean. Like, I don't even know they're saying. Like, the most hurtful things I would say to you.
Okay.
Right. Like, I would dehumanize you. Because I can't put a round in you. I can't punch you. I'm not going to punch you. I'm not, like, a violent person. Which, thankfully, like, I don't know how I haven't been like that. I just use my words.
Okay.
Understood. Right. Like,
And so after this moment at the mm-hmm. you know, hospital, or really your second time going out, giving your story once again.
Yeah, the second time.
The second time, which yeah. you wanted to do.
I did.
How did that experience compare to saying it the first time?
It was like kind of like this. It was super conversational.
Mm-hmm.
And the therapist, there's like three therapists that go into the war room. Like their specific therapists, like the good therapists will go in the war room because it's a deep, like it's a place that gets real deep and emotional. So the therapist that day was like, we're going to go over moral injury. And I'm like, well, I could share, right? Cause mine's a moral injury story. And there was a bunch of new people on there. Now this is week like 5.5 for me.
So you are a seasoned veteran.
Oh, I was the OG. At that point,
you're probably a pretty prominent personality amongst the group of patients.
Yeah.
Okay, so and you're very much a leader within the hospital.
Yes.
Yeah. On the patient side.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I told the therapist, I'm like, I'll share my story, so you don't like, it's a perfect example. Like, you're gonna give like examples of moral injury, you know, via you know books, right? Like, I'll give mine. That's real life and I've experienced.
So after you gave that, what did the therapist use as learning points from your story?
The whole story, she didn't even have to do anything, right? Because my whole story is verbatim, like textbook moral injury.
Mm-hmm.
There's other institutional betrayal would be things... Right, like if it needs, yeah. don't want to get down that rabbit hole. But mine was textbook of like, this is something that a person is morally not, it's not right, right? Like, you as an American, all these Americans, even the people listening, right? Like, there's right and wrong. And things you just don't do as a human. So it was textbook.
So as you left the hospital, mm-hmm. at what point, because you got extended a couple weeks.
So normally it's 28 days. It's a 28-day stay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was there for, we'll just say 50 days.
So you got extended.
Yeah, I was on team extension.
Okay.
Yep.
And why did they make you extend?
Because I just wasn't there by week 3, right? So like
how do they calculate that? How is that? How are they making that call?
I don't know. It's a medical call, but like really I wasn't having the progression that I was supposed to, right? Because this like by week 3 I was still fighting back subconsciously therapy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wasn't like, you know?
And really, it was the moment that you went up and told your story that the floodgates somewhat opened.
It was actually the week before that with someone else's story in the war room. So someone else's story and their like personal experience and their, you know, what they're thinking now triggered me to have my moment of like, whoa, that's, yeah. Like it just hit me in a way of like allowing me to feel safe to let go.
Right.
Yeah. So that person's experience helped me. And that's the magical part of the war room.
Right. And that's why the tribe is built.
That's why the tribe is built.
So as you did progress mm-hmm. and made your way through your extension.
Yep.
How did your experience change? How did your emotional state change?
So I was less stressed, more open. Really my true self came out, right? Like, this is very personable person. Like people, come to me for things, for advice and, they just like, and that's the thing we went over in therapy too. Like I have a very, personality.
Extroverted.
Yeah, extroverted, and people tend to
gravitate
towards me. And it's part of the reason we started the podcast, right? Like I've always had that in me, like especially as a Marine, right? Like I was always had that, that ability. So it really started to come out of like my personality.
And so, as you were wrapping up, were you excited to leave?
It was bittersweet and scary as shit. I was happy to get out of the walls and like the rules and regulations of Laurel Ridge. But I was scared. I didn't know what I was coming back to.
And as you've transitioned out, has it been a struggle to maintain your therapy and the, you know, the emotional goodness that's done for you as you've come back and left the confines of the hospital and had to once again fight your real life problems?
It's a challenge every day. Like mm-hmm. it's a challenge, right? Because I'm leaving a controlled environment back into the real world, right? Laurel Ridge is extremely controlled. Everything's controlled, right? It's all scripted, we'll say. And now you're going back with the wolves. So yeah, it's a struggle every day and just finding, one, utilizing the techniques that you learned, and then having it click, right? Like you think it's clicking in the hospital. Like, yeah, I'm leaving and I'm clicking. But then you hit the real world and you're like, whoa, I'm not clicking. What is going on?
And as they release you, do they because every patient gets released back to the civilian or yep. to the regular world,
yep.
Whether it's the military or civilian world. What do they tell you to prepare you for that transition? Because you could argue that transition is just as traumatic as going into the hospital.
Yeah. So I think, all right, I'll walk the line here. After this, it's a step down process, right? It's supposed to be a step down. So you're supposed to go from inpatient back into an intense outpatient.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically going every day to counseling.
Right.
And doing like the same thing that you're doing there, but you're not.
But you're just living at home.
You're just living at home.
Got it.
And then after that, then it's like another step down where it's, you know, you're just going to counseling.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's a tiered approach.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, yeah, it's a step down process.
But with that being said, every military installation is different. Depends on where you're coming from. Maybe some military installations don't have that intense outpatient.
Right. So it is the capabilities of where you're coming from that
yeah.
do have a hand in dictating
yep.
the...
aftercare.
The aftercare
yep.
and the overall value provided to the patient.
Yep. Yeah.
And as you've left, what kind of drugs are you still on?
I'm still on the same Lexapro 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take a sleeping medicine.
And did you start taking the sleeping medicine once you left?
No, I took it when I was there.
Okay, you took that as well.
Yeah.
Understood.
Yeah, so sorry, I left that area.
So, well, Gunnar, I think this has been a fascinating podcast. I really appreciate you sharing your story. Thank you so much for, again, everything you do. And I think as you and I dive into this deeper and deeper, we're going to make a lot of we're going to create a lot of value for people going through similar experiences as you have in
yeah.
similar trials and tribulations.
Yeah, awesome.
Thanks again. All
right, man. Thanks, dude.